Welcome to Plant Stories.
The modern, the old, and the crazy in between.
Absinthe was first created in the 1790s by Pierre Ordinaire, a French doctor living in Switzerland. Dr. Ordinaire created absinthe with the intent for it to be used as an alcohol-based elixir, distilled from the bitter-tasting herb Artemisia absinthium, or wormwood. That brings us into today's episode, Absinthe.
It's the pretty green fairy.
How did I do on my slightly stumbled pronunciation?
Probably better than I will while I try to talk about all these French things. I didn't realize what I was getting into when I started, but here we are. Absinthe doesn't even sound like a French word to me, but I don't know. You know how it is. I said that this was going to be a short episode, but it turns out it's not. So, sorry, guys.
It's okay. We're all here to learn.
Yeah, and honestly, it was too interesting for me to leave a bunch of crap out. You know, this is an intriguing tale of ancient beginnings and murder.
Really? And, okay.
Yeah. There's a lot. There's a lot to unpack here. So, absinthe is a flavored distilled liquor that is typically a yellowish green color. I think more green most of the time, but sometimes it can be a little bit yellow. And when water is added to it, it kind of morphs into like a cloudy, opalescent whitish green. So it's magical. It changes color. Woo! The word absinthe is considered French, and it's believed to have come actually from an ancient Greek word, absinthion, which sounds like, I don't know, like the Parthenon or something, but it's not. And some people actually just translate it as undrinkable, which is, that's sad. I assume if you drink straight up wormwood, it tastes pretty bitter. And so that's kind of why some people think that it originates from this undrinkable word. Some people also think it might be related to the Persian root word spand or aspand, which was used in relation to another herb, Syrian rue, which is known for being pretty bitter. So it might have just been like, it's kind of like another one of these, or it could be that it actually came from the word absinthion. Either way, you know, we now know it as absinthe. It's considered highly aromatic and is like dry and a little bit bitter in taste. The chief flavoring ingredients are primarily the leaves and flowers of wormwood, which is Artemisia absinthium, which is then usually enhanced with more flavors of kind of licorice, anise, hyssop, angelica, and fennel. So these are kind of like traditional European herbs. So, like you said, you know, the beverage was first created by Pierre Ordinaire. And he was a French doctor living in Switzerland. There were a couple of different recipes that kind of circulated around for a little bit. And even though he was really the first one to kind of create it, the first person to produce it in mass was Henri-Louis Pernod. And he decided he was going to, you know, actually make a distillery where they produce this because he saw potential in it. And he used a recipe that had actually been purchased by his father-in-law, Major Dubois, from a woman sometimes considered the, quote, mother of absinthe, named Henriette Henrot. See, I'm just so terrible at French. To concoct the beverage. And so then this first distillery was opened in Switzerland, and later another distillery was opened in France after the drink kind of started gaining notoriety. The beverage is probably most well known for being popular among artists and writers from the late 18th, early 19th century. So some of those figures include Pablo Picasso, James Joyce, Van Gogh, Oscar Wilde, Ernest Hemingway. It was well known for being really kind of like a liberating beverage for these artists. And in part, I think that's why it gained this popularity. So in the classic, like traditional French sense, absinthe is meant to be enjoyed by slowly dripping water over a sugar cube that's placed on a spoon suspended at the top of a cup, which then adds sugar water to the absinthe. So this is not just like a, you know, oh, I grabbed a beer and sat down on my couch and watched TV. Like, this is a process, but honestly, like, I'm so intrigued by that process. It's classy. Like, I'm ready to dive into, it's 2021. New things are coming. Like, I'm ready to dive into some classy drinking with all the accoutrement. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, ceremonies and intent really bring it to another level.
Yeah, so even then, this was high-class drinking. And so this addition of the water actually causes a chemical reaction that releases flavor and changes the color of the absinthe, which is called the louche. And after this occurs, it's recommended that you do not add any additional ice or water to the mixture, as the flavors will continue to emerge as the ice melts and as, you know, this reaction continues. So it's kind of like, basically it breaks down some of the herbs and things that's like in the absinthe itself and like separate some of the molecules so you get more of the flavor. And like, you know how if you put two drops of water next to each other, they combine into one drop of water?
Sure.
But like if you put two bubbles next to each other, they'd like stick together, but they wouldn't combine.
Yes. You get it? Yeah. Okay. I got you. Okay.
So absinthe is kind of like that where the molecules involved, they touch each other, but they don't actually combine. So you get kind of like each of the flavors separately instead of one combined new thing.
That's why it looks cloudy.
That exactly. That's what causes the cloudy color. Sometimes there are certain, you know, especially in distilling, there are certain processes that you can do to kind of change some of these things. Or if you wanted it to be more clear, you could make it more clear. Typically, it's not really clear. But it's also not like doesn't have enough surface tension, the molecules don't, to like completely separate the way that like oil and water does. So that's why you get that cloudiness. Me trying to explain science. This is why I'm not a science teacher. Hello.
You're doing a great job.
Teachers are great. Anyway. So obviously, like I said, the most notable plant associated with absinthe, and probably, arguably, the most important plant is wormwood, which is a perennial plant that kind of has many branches sprouting out from a woody base. It's not quite a bush per se, but it's got that kind of vibe. It usually grows about 5 feet tall and has leaves with like a gray-green color and a scent similar to that of sage. And they get really cute little yellow flowers. Cute, cute.
Sounds pretty nice.
Yeah. Lots of people really like wormwood. There are actually about 200 different types of wormwood, and many of those types are actually decorative. There's pretty much a type of wormwood that grows in every region of the world, you know, save Antarctica.
Sure.
Or other places like that that are very, very cold, but they grow in most places, and Artesima absinthium is really just one of many types of wormwood. It's in the same family as tarragon, sagebrush, and mugwort. So it's a relatively common plant. And wormwood has been used for thousands of years as a medicinal product. Its earliest records go back to ancient Egypt. So the Egyptian Ebers Papyrus, which was a medical document that dates back to 1550 BC, although it's believed it may actually be a copy of earlier works dating back several more centuries, mentions the plant's use for intestinal distress and killing roundworms. In ancient Greece, wormwood was mixed with honey for pretty similar medicinal purposes, and to make the drink, you know, like ingestible, that they would mix it with the honey. And in China, wormwood was turned into medicinal wines. So it was common to make medicinal wine by basically soaking wormwood in some other type of beverage, liquor, wine, beer, to make it ingestible and used for general medicine. And it's been confirmed that this has been used in China through chemical analysis of drinking vessels found at archaeological sites.
It's amazing what science can find from the past.
I know. It's just crazy how, you know, it's just like residue. Like residue that's probably lasted for like hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Some other unconfirmed uses for wormwood include increasing sex drive, helping with insect bites, being an anti-parasitic, and Crohn's disease treatments. Like I said, these are unconfirmed, so I cannot guarantee that any of these things would necessarily help you, but there is some evidence, you know, for some of these things, just not confirmed. It's believed that part of the reason for adding wormwood in general to alcohol, other than for purely medicinal purposes, could be that it both improved the flavor by adding kind of like an extra little bit of bitterness to that flavor profile, and to help kind of disguise the stench and maybe some of the tummy hurting after effects of crudely made alcoholic beverages. So that makes sense to me. Even absinthe has a crazy high alcohol content, especially in this time period. Now, you know, we make what, Everclear and crap like that. But like, for the other alcohols that we've been talking about this time, absinthe has very high alcohol content. French soldiers were actually given distilled wormwood rations as a treatment to prevent malaria, as well as fever and dysentery in the 1840s when troops were sent to battle in West Africa. And oftentimes they mixed this with wine to kind of cut the bitterness and provide a little extra healing. You know? Make you go to sleep.
Yeah. That seems to be the one of the benefits of all of these alcohol-based treatments.
Yeah. And there is some evidence that it is helpful in treating the symptoms of malaria. So I saw some reports that said that they were just like given rations of absinthe. It seems more likely that they were probably given distilled wormwood that was then kind of like mixed with other things, at least at first. And then as absinthe started to be produced, you know, from these distilleries that started up a little bit after this, then they were given rations of absinthe to, you know, make it easier for them to send it over. I cannot confirm that because that's just my personal observation from all the things that I've read. Nothing specifically said that. It was usually either one or the other, but based off of the like dates that I got from those things, that's what I think probably happened.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a historian. I just like to read stuff. There's a lot of kind of myths pertaining to the hallucinogenic properties, both of wormwood and of absinthe. And it kind of relates directly back to the compound thujone. So in large doses, thujone is considered toxic and even fatal. People who have a lot of thujone might suffer seizures or, you know, other kind of like unusual behavior. But the amount of thujone in absinthe, and typically even in most like medical situations, is not enough to be considered deadly or even hallucinogenic. Like if you were just to eat wormwood off of the plant, enough of it to maybe, I don't know, like make a salad or something, you'd be very ill. But typically there's not that much. And thujone itself actually exists in a lot of different plants that we ingest. But when it comes to absinthe and wormwood specifically, because of some of the history that we're about to talk about, there are some restrictions on thujone. There are other alcoholic beverages other than absinthe which contain wormwood, such as vermouth, something called Genepi, a French aperitif called Quina, some schnapps, and also even some beers and wines. In fact, all European vermouth contained some wormwood. So,
is that just like a regional tradition?
It's like a regional quality thing. Like, it's not considered vermouth there unless it has the wormwood in it.
Gotcha.
And for a while, wormwood was even used as a substitute for hops in some early beers of the Middle Ages, both as a bittering agent and an antimicrobial that helped against the spoiling of beer. So, you know, it was one of the experimental things in that time period we talked about in our beer episode, where people were trying to figure out what would make their beer last the longest.
Right.
Absinthe really saw, kind of culturally, a big, you know, uptick and then just like a major downtick before, you know, coming back into the consciousness in more recent years. And so a big factor that contributed to the rise of absinthe was this pest that destroyed most of the vineyards in France, which I'm sure we'll talk about in our wine episode. But there at one point was a pest that just destroyed wine vines that had been around for many, many, many years. And so, as there was suddenly this shortage in wine, now, you know, absinthe was kind of coming onto the scene. And so the timing of that worked out really well for absinthe. There was also kind of this thing that when troops who had developed a taste for this wormwood-based kind of absinthe-y beverage returned to France, absinthe was now less expensive because it was being more mass-produced, and wine was now in short supply and much more expensive. And so that really solidified its role in French culture, because it might have still been a little difficult, I think, for absinthe to come onto the scene if it weren't for these soldiers who already kind of had a taste for it and were, you know, kind of already buying it as soon as they came back. So pretty quickly in French cafes, 5 p.m. became known as the green hour, or l'heure verte, which was similar to the American happy hour. Oh, and yeah. Was like the time absinthe came out. You're like, yeah, bring it on. And by the early 1900s, the drink had really climbed to the height of French popularity. And many of the French referred to the drink as Le Fée Verte, which is the green fairy. It was considered this drink of liberation that could like shed new light on the world. These rumors of its kind of like hallucinogenic properties that were really probably related to its alcohol content and not actually related to being hallucinogenic per se. But, you know, bygones be bygones. People were like, I'm going to try it. I like it. This is great. It was cheap in comparison to wine. And, you know, so you got all these artists who are touting its positive factors. And initially it was kind of enjoyed more by like the middle and upper class, but quickly the drink was spread among the population. Like, the first people to hear of it, I feel like, are always the rich people who are, like, importing the stuff from other places, you know, in the beginning when it first comes expensive. But then once it becomes well-liked, it's for everybody now. And as it began to kind of take off in France, its popularity also spread throughout Europe. So, you know, the shortage of wine wasn't only felt by the French, although it was felt quite heavily by the French. You know, everyone at this time drank a lot of wine. They all liked wine. Wine was great. And then there was no wine. So, you know, it started to turn over. The Spanish actually were particularly fond of absinthe. Really enjoyed it. Were like, this is 10 out of 10. They're actually one of the only countries to never have banned the beverage at all. They never did it. And so the drink was actually brought to the U.S. by a Spanish bartender named Caetano Ferrer, who honed his craft in the Catalan region of Spain. Because there, you know, they loved it. And then he opened the Old Absinthe House in New Orleans on Bourbon Street, which was originally called the Absinthe Room. And so by 1878, it's estimated that around 8 million liters of absinthe were being imported into the U.S.
That is a crazy surge.
Yeah. It's like, well, yesterday we didn't like it, but you know, it's starting to grow on me.
Yeah, I guess they brought it into the market. It just blew up. Good for him. I bet that was a really great business for a while.
Yeah, you know, until all the other stuff happened. So, you know, eventually we kind of get into this period that, you know, starts in the early 1900s where the sentiments around the unruly behavior that comes with alcohol began to change, and therefore so did the feelings around absinthe. Even in the late 1800s, kind of the complaints about the disintegration of French culture were not uncommon. So there were people doing studies, you know, about how, like, alcohol was bad. There are a couple studies about how absinthe was bad and how it was ruining the French people and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, public opinion was, like, sort of starting to sway that way, but wasn't sold on the idea. Plenty of people still really liked alcohol. And, you know, we know that this drink's just, like, incredibly high alcohol content really is probably what drove these crazy behaviors. But because of this, it was specifically, you know, targeted as being bad. And therefore, it was given the name the Green Devil or the Green Demon. Unfortunate things began in the 1900s, when in 1901, the original absinthe distillery, made by, you know, our friend Henry, caught fire due to a lightning strike. And that started to cause an absinthe shortage. Because one of their major distilleries was then out of commission. Now, probably all these things, you know, maybe on their own or maybe over years of time, but all of this was happening very quickly. And ultimately, they culminated in what was known by the media, you know, what the media was then, like newspapers and people talking and stuff.
Yep.
As Town the absinthe Friars. Murder. Yeah. The absinthe murder. Dun, dun, dun. Which is honestly totally ridiculous. And this is, like, such a classic example of, like, people twisting things to their advantage. But a man by the name of Jean Nafre, who was a French factory worker in Camungi, Switzerland. I'm sure I'm probably saying that wrong, but in Switzerland, murdered his wife along with their unborn son, which he did not know at the time, and two daughters after a full day of drinking. And that day of drinking started with a shot of absinthe. So he says that when he woke up in the morning, he poured some water into a shot of absinthe and chugged it. He continued to drink all day to the point where he came home and his wife called him lazy and he told her to shut up. And she said, make me. And then he turned around and shot her in the head. And then when his first older daughter came to see what was the matter, he shot her in the head. And then he walked into the other room and shot the baby in the head. And he kind of, you know, attempted to be like, it was the absinthe. I would have never done this if I hadn't been drinking the green demon. Which is completely ludicrous. Like, I can't think of any time. And I've been pretty intoxicated. I'll admit I'm not really a blackout type of gal. But, you know, like, I can't ever think of a time where I was like, I know what I'm going to do. Literally shoot someone right now.
Like, and not just anyone, my whole family.
My entire family. Just going to take them out. Like, you know, there was something else wrong with this guy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But it was dubbed the absinthe murder and, you know, continued to be used for some time as an argument against the continuation of manufacturing absinthe and getting it banned. Soon in Geneva, there was another murder that they related to someone drinking absinthe that was considered kind of its own absinthe murder. And this kind of nationwide sentiment started to turn negatively towards absinthe, specifically, really, not necessarily alcohol in general, as it is in some places. So Belgium actually banned the beverage in 1905, followed by the Switzerland and the Netherlands in 1910, the US in 1912, and France in 1915. So while alcohol had been targeted by prohibitionists, you know, kind of worldwide in general for a while, this was the first time that a single beverage was really targeted and specifically marked for, you know, like being discontinued. And I think it's also kind of important to note that while this was happening, wine was kind of like making a comeback. So we'll talk about it more again in our wine episode later on, but, you know, they had figured out a way basically to kind of revive some of the wineries. There had been some time that had gone by, so a lot of these places were starting to produce grapes again. And so clearly it was in their best interest to kind of, you know, get absinthe out of the way. So absinthe was kind of presented as this evil drink, you know, this devilish drink, whereas wine was like the healthy, classy option. You know, like,
that didn't make you murder people.
Yeah, like if you were going to use one of these medicinally, like this is what you were going to do. And so, I mean, for a pretty long time, you know, absinthe really stays out of kind of the public consciousness. There are still some kind of like wormwoody beverages that appear. You know, some places kind of like in smaller groups still use it medicinally, but it doesn't really make a revival until the 1990s. That's a pretty long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, not just even, you know, those like absinthe itself, but certain levels of thujone in beverages were banned in Europe. And so in 1988, the EU decided to change those laws, and indirectly, that actually made absinthe legal again. So, you know, not having, quote, any absinthe in your beverage usually relates to being about like 10 ppm or parts per million in the beverage. And so you know, now it was kind of suddenly like legal again to have regular amount of thujone. And so if it wasn't banned specifically by name in your country, then now you could technically make it again. And the first people to be like, hey, you know, maybe we can make this again, were the Czech Republic, actually. And, you know, so the Czech Republic, they, you know, around kind of the same-ish time as France, although like much later, really, they started, you know, drinking absinthe. Like, it became very popular specifically in Prague, but it doesn't really show up until like the 1890s, and then they made a bunch of distilleries and then it got banned. So like, it was like popular there for like a little bit. And so it kind of makes sense, though, that that's kind of how it gets like remembered. Like, somebody there is, they already really liked it, apparently. And somebody there was like, oh, wait, we can make this again. And so they start producing some different types of absinthe to the point where, like, it was considered very popular for people to ask for like green drinks, especially foreigners, because they thought that that was absinthe. And they started producing what was known as Hill's Absinthe around 1997. Now, this was considered, quote, bohemian-style absinthe. It actually had very little in common with original absinthe. But it was really instrumental in reigniting interest in the beverage again. In the UK, they also realized they'd never actually officially banned the beverage. And so they started importing it about a year later from them. And, you know, eventually making some of their own. It was considered kind of a more, like, expensive, like, high-class beverage. And as its popularity and kind of those old rumors of, like, hallucinogenic properties and, like, you know, high alcohol content and all that stuff really kind of, like, resurfaced, so did demand. And eventually other manufacturers throughout Europe started making the beverage, especially in Spain, because we remember how much the Spain, you know, market was booming. And even though kind of all of these compounds mostly began with like other liquors that had wormwood flavors added or were like distilled with wormwood or something, slowly interest in the original recipes returned. And they started manufacturing kind of the recipes that we know today. Oddly, the beverage had been available in Japan since the 1950s. And it was called Hermes Absinthe. But they closed in 1987, just before the product's European revival.
I bet that hurt to watch.
I know, they're probably like, oh, darn it.
So close. Who could have guessed, you know?
Yeah, you know, you just don't know. But I did think that was sadly ironic. Slowly but surely, bans began to lift across Europe. So by 2000, France was making its own kind of version of absinthe again. Bans were lifted in Switzerland in 2005 and in the US in 2007. So that's actually pretty recent. I mean, is that 14 years ago? I'm bad at math.
2007? 13? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's really not that long ago.
Well, I guess it's 2021 now, but
that's what I was thinking. I think that's why I did 14. But so there are still restrictions on the amount of thujone that can be in beverages, although, oddly, like I said, this is found in so many other herbs, like sage and stuff, which are commonly ingested at higher ratios than what would be in absinthe, but we'll just not worry about that. And so in the limit of the US is 10 ppm, which is technically considered like none. While in the EU, they can have up to 35 ppm, parts per million. I just like saying ppm. I also like saying parts per million. I don't know. It's the alliteration. It gets me every time. So now, you know, it's something that many people enjoy. I would like to enjoy it. I lied to you when I said I was going to buy some, mostly because I'm poor, but also because I realized I don't have all the fun accoutrements and I don't want to do it if I don't have all the pieces. I need the spoon. I need the glass. I need the fountain. What am I doing without all those things? This is a process. This is an experience. So,
yes.
You know, but I think it just, it's so crazy. It's so crazy that the media has the power to do something like that. And I wonder, you know, we think about it now because it happens so quick. And like, how interesting is it that even then it was, they were able to sway public opinion so quickly that way to almost completely obliterate this beverage. I mean, that's insane.
I can only assume the motivation was market manipulation, you know, probably somebody mad that it was exploded and probably super profitable.
They were able to use the movement of prohibitionists, really.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in the U.S., that was kind of, you know, already on its way to happening.
Yep.
But, you know, I guess we've talked a little bit about it in some of our episodes that there was kind of this backlash where alcohol was concerned in a lot of places, I guess. Like, and there's so much more to it kind of like internationally that I just wasn't, I think, aware of. I think in the U.S. everybody's kind of heard of prohibition and we think of it as like the 1920s and like speakeasies and blah, blah, blah. I mean, absinthe here, that was probably really the beginning if you think of it like being banned in 1912. So sentiments must have already been starting at that time where they were kind of gathering steam to roll right into the 1920s. So those are just my thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think I couldn't make this episode that short, you guys. I had to include all this stuff. And honestly, I cut it down a lot. You know, if you're ever interested in reading about it, there's a lot more about kind of like the absinthe murders and also kind of the cultural sentiments in France at the time that would have, you know, encouraged, like I said, some of those things about how, you know, French culture is disintegrating and stuff like that. There's a lot of information about that. That you can find out there that is just like really interesting to read and how this is related to that. So I encourage you to go out and look for yourself, but I just thought it was pretty crazy. I also think it's pretty crazy that a man tried to just be like, yep, I murdered my wife and children because of absinthe. But I guess men who murder their entire family, you know, they'll find any excuse.
Oh, yeah.
In case you're interested, he did, in fact, still get convicted of the murder of his family and then killed himself in jail.
Oh, a happy ending.
Just in case you wanted to hear something really bleak in this morning, afternoon, evening time you're listening to our podcast. But
hopefully middle of the night. Let it be spooky.
But yeah, it's true that, you know, that did happen, and his defense did try to be like, it was absinthe madness! And they're like,
just like reefer madness.
Well, they're like, yeah, he also drank a crap ton of alcohol after that. Like, if it was alcohol induced, like, it was, I think initially when they wrote about it, it says like, oh, he drank only absinthe and that, but you know, like, it came out during the trial that he was not just drinking absinthe, he was drinking a whole lot of stuff. And honestly, I am excited for the day that I get to try it. This is like on my mind now.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely will. And I'll take pictures and put it on Instagram.
Yay.
I'm a terrible Instagram poster, because I've suddenly become very busy, but I try for you guys. And even like, I don't know, the inclusion of wormwood. Wormwood is something I never would have imagined in a drink when I've like touched it or seen it in person. You guys can grow it really easily if you choose to grow it in your home or in your backyard or whatever. It's pretty hardy. I recommend not necessarily trying to make absinthe because you'll probably mess it up and you would have to have a still. But, you know, it is supposedly a very good ornamental plant and very easy to take care of. So if you're looking for like an interesting garden plant, many, many garden cellar places have them. But enough of me yapping. Let's go ahead and walk over to the bar. Hang out with our bartender friend Krista for a few minutes.
Hello, friends. First, I'm going to teach you a little history. One of my favorite fun facts about absinthe is a wonderful recipe made by Ernest Hemingway. We got a quote from him, a piece of his advice from 1935. Here's how you make it. You pour one jigger of absinthe into a champagne glass. Add iced champagne until it attains the proper opalescent milkiness. Drink 3 to 5 of these slowly. I would recommend drinking fewer than 5, but I do love the idea that that was his lifestyle. I have never heard of a recipe with iced champagne, so definitely intriguing. You can also try pouring the absinthe on top. Some brands of absinthe will float for a little bit on the champagne, which makes another cool effect. I think visual effects is definitely part of the experience of absinthe. I also wanted to go through the traditional practice of prepping this drink. So we kind of talked about the tools and the process earlier, but just to go through one more time. You're going to need your fine absinthe, a glass. You can use a wine glass, an absinthe spoon.
It's kind of expensive, guys. So.
Yes, it is. You can use an absinthe spoon, or if you really need to, you can use a regular fork, sugar, and a carafe full of ice cold water. It could just be in a glass. So the absinthe spoon, if you haven't looked it up already by now, is the most unique part of this. So it's flat and perforated. It kind of looks like a trowel, like a garden tool. It's got an indented area in the handle so that you can just place it on the edge of the glass. And then the perforations will allow the water and the melting sugar to pass into the glass of absinthe below. But similar to coffee or tea, the sugar is up to the drinker's preference. If you do use it, try to get cubed sugar, not just loose grains. So you want to pour 1 ounce of absinthe into the glass, and then you're going to place the spoon across the rim of the glass with the notch of the spoon resting on the rim, and you place a sugar cube on the spoon. If you're using a carafe, begin by pouring a small amount of water onto the sugar, saturating it, allow it to sit for a minute or two so that the sugar begins to loosen and dissolve on its own, and then you begin slowly drizzling a very slender stream of water onto the sugar cube. Typically, you would see labels on absinthe bottles that'll say 5 ounces of water to 1 ounce of absinthe, so that'll make it, you know, around a 6 ounce drink and dilute it to about like a 12 to 14% alcohol, which is actually kind of similar to like a glass of wine. And you can enjoy the visual effects as we have planned to do this while sitting near a beautiful crackling fire and having long artistic conversations of the drinkers of past.
Yeah, basically what I want you to picture, and this is important, even if you've never met us, is like 2 very classy looking women sitting in front of a very like elaborate fireplace, possibly in like a, I don't know, like a, you know, fancy house somewhere, probably maybe like a cabin in the woods kind of deal, but like not like a cabin in the woods the movie, just like an actual cabin in actual woods that is not dangerous or scary. And then between us is like a small table with this like little absinthe fountain, and we're like chatting by the fire while we turn the little absinthe fountain on to drip our little sugar spoons water stuff into our cups and drinking. That's what I picture for us, and that's what I hope our listeners can also picture.
Aesthetically, I imagine that it's all on like a mirrored tray. That sounds nice.
That does sound extra classy. Yes, add the mirrored tray to your to your visual.
Yeah, when you do your online shopping cart for all of the supplies, do that too.
Yeah, you know, but wow, just like absinthe is such a classy beverage. Who would have known?
Well, that makes sense why it attracted artists. It's like it's a ritual and it's visually interesting.
And it's very intoxicating, which I don't know if you've met or been an artist or a writer.
Just drink 3 to 5 of these for a death in the afternoon.
These are the same people who were like in love with laudanum, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know.
Well, what are we going to talk about in our next episode?
In our next episode, we're going to do gin.
Ooh, yay.
Yeah,
I really like gin.
See, I don't know. It's like, am I just a basic white girl, or do I just like, I don't know.
I feel like gin is the basic white girl. It's like a bouquet. It's great.
I don't know. I'm like, give me a margarita. I'm like, that's a horrible thing I just said. But like,
I mean, margaritas are great. No shame. Yeah.
I'm over here like, I'm too old to not drink if my drink doesn't taste good. Sorry. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't drink many alcohols, I guess, alone. Like, I'm a mixed beverage gal.
Yeah. Well, yeah, gin's not great on its own, but it's, I would describe it as lovely and very aromatic. And it also seems to be having a bit of a resurgence. I don't know if that's a regional thing, but there's a lot of newer gin distilleries.
Yes. So,
that's cool.
And I think we'll be talking about that fans. in our next episode. I'm sure you'll edit out some of my babbling, hopefully.
Oh, not at all.
You're like, no, everyone needs to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're so glad that everyone joined us this week for our episode on absinthe, blessed by the Green Fairy, because we are blessed by the Green Fairy. It's a beautiful thing, and I'm very excited to hop on the absinthe train, if you know what I mean. And we hope that you enjoyed this episode. Where are we again? I forget all the platforms. Do you remember them, Krista?
Instagram, Facebook, Spotify, Apple Music, SoundCloud. Anywhere. I think everywhere. I think the answer is everywhere.
We're everywhere. When you turn on your phone, we're all over that phone. No, I'm just kidding.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully soon we'll get some new stats about how many views that we've been getting and where we're ranking in different categories, and we'll be happy to share those with you guys.
And please contact us. You can send us messages on Facebook, on Instagram. We have an email address. If you have something you're interested in, or if you have questions, or if you even want to correct me, I'm down. Let's do it.
We are here to learn.